Hello all, my name is Rob Farley. I am a professor at the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky. And today we have with us Mr. Matt Duss, who is the National Security Editor at the Center for American Progress. Now, viewers from yesterday will almost certainly understand that, and I can't really see Matt right now, but I assume that there are flames in the background, that there are broken windows and so forth. I mean, his worldview has been shattered, and I assume that this requires some sort of physical destruction for his surroundings as well. I assume his hair is disheveled in some way. How are things there, Matt? Are people still getting enough food?
No, it's pretty rough. As you can see, as you will soon see, things are really it's pretty grim over here.
Right. I mean, that's a tragedy, really.
Yeah, we just don't know what to do.
Right. So, how are you pushing forward?
I don't know. I'm watching a lot of daytime TV. Drinking a lot of tea. I'm listening to a lot of Sarah McLachlan. I'm just trying to, light candles and chill out, basically.
I mean, the tea is supposed to be good in situations like that, or so I'm told. I've never actually, I'm not I'm really a tea drinker, but
Hot
it's
baths are
supposed to be
good,
good.
long baths.
And they
So
have the facilities for that at CAP, huh?
they do, actually, yeah. All the time.
Oh, well.
Just ongoing.
That's that's quite impressive. Regarding your worldview being shattered, may I assume that you don't fully agree with this assertion from all of our good friend Eli Lake? Or give me your thoughts on his.
Well, no, it's funny. I got I get this email from our good friend saying that said, "Hey, Eli made this very interesting comment about you." And I'm flattered, of course. I should just start by saying that, I'm flattered that Eli is so concerned here. But as anyone who's watched our Twitter exchanges, they understand that I'm all up in Eli's head. So he's going to make these assertions about the shattering of my worldview. But so I mean, I guess his what he's saying is the to the extent that I can understand it, it's that the WikiLeaks cables, by showing that that Arab leaders support an attack on Iran, discredits everything I've ever said or thought. Now.
Well, no, I mean, I can sort of see where he's coming from. I mean, not really, but I mean, he called me a moral idiot on Twitter the other day. I think he was a moral idiot. I don't require exa re recall exactly. But maybe you'd go ahead and explain why the cables don't, in fact, shatter everything that you've ever written about Iran.
Well, no, I mean, I think he's, again, I mean, let's just back up from here. I mean, Eli's a good friend. I love the guy. But he does have this tendency to kind of play private Eli and public Eli, and you've experienced this with him as well, both in private and public. You have these conversations with him describing your view, and you walk away from them thinking that you've kind of explained to him what your position is on any given subject, and the next time you talk to him, it's as if that previous conversation never happened. It's a sort of
Right, I think the
groundhog.
reset button on the back of his head is how you
Right,
characterized it in the
it's a sort
past.
of Groundhog Day experience. Now, I mean, and the thing is here, I mean, Eli and I actually had a conversation in public on Twitter about, a few months ago when there was the UAE ambassador who made these comments in Aspen in support of, saying that, given the choice between a nuclear Iran and an attack on Iran, he would take the latter. And, I, having had many meetings with Arab, diplomats and representatives over my few years here at the center, this was not news to me. I've heard this before. And I said this to him on Twitter, so it's really, it's just, I want to give him the benefit of the doubt and assume he's just, he's afflicted with some kind of psychosis, above and beyond the psychosis that is neoconservatism. I don't want to assume he's just being dishonest, but it really gets kind of frustrating here. So, I mean,
Well,
my
he's a performer. It's a performance, as I think you've suggested before. And I mean, really, and you following it on Twitter and even in blogging heads and so forth, it's really sort of admirably consistent in its performance.
But I mean, to get to the crux of the issue, no. I mean, as I wrote yesterday, the fact that Arab leaders are deeply concerned about Iran, for a number of reasons. First, the whole basic, they don't want Iran supporting terrorism in their backyard. A lot of it has to do with an Arab-Persian influenced game. But seriously, I mean, they take Iran's nuclear program and its support for terrorism, understandably, they look at it very gravely. I was surprised at the persistence and the explicitness with which a lot of these leaders have been calling for a military attack. But having said that, I mean, it's just really funny that, I mean, a lot of the people who have seized upon this, you know, Bill Kristol on down, all the neoconservatives, it's really funny to say, okay, now we should believe what the Arabs are saying. After years of denying that the Arabs really cared about the Israel-Palestinian issue, despite the fact that Arabs are always saying they care about the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And, of course, the the cables themselves show, in private, Arab leaders do care about the Israeli-Palestinian issue. I wrote this yesterday, too, pushing back on, you know, the latest piece of hackery from Jennifer Rubin, saying that the cables disprove the linkage argument. And, well, no, in fact, they actually strengthen it. So, but what are you going to do?
Right, there's a stunning and quite surprising interest in the private attitudes of authoritarian Arab leaders, right? Mm-hmm. And to the extent that suddenly it's as if neocons have ever cared about what these people think, right? Where there is no evidence in the past that, you know, if for example, the King of Saudi Arabia had said it would be a terrible idea to attack Iran, I doubt that William Kristol would give a damn, right? I doubt that Eli would give a damn either.
Right.
And so it is fascinating, sort of talking about the sort of the policy consequence of these views as something that's sort of particularly relevant for the United States in deciding whether to attack Iran.
Right. I mean, what I do. I mean, let's go. I mean, going back to, you know, the freedom agenda and the Bush Doctrine and all this stuff, and I'll have a piece on this in the American Prospect, I guess, the same day this is going up. It's just, and I think Andrew Sullivan has been really great on this issue as well. It's like, remember all that stuff about, you know, regime change and democratization and this tsunami of freedom that was going to overtake the Middle East in the wake of our glorious invasion of Iraq. Well, that's, you know, forget it. That's last year's model. I mean, now these same authoritarian leaders are our allies against Iran. And it's like, as if you needed yet another definitive demonstration of neoconservatives' bad faith. Well, here it is.
Right. Well, I mean, I would call it neoconservative indifference to the principles that neoconservatism is supposed to be about, which are democracy, right? When democracy is inconvenient, is inconvenient to a hawkish vision of American nationalism, then democracy is discarded, right? It's window dressing, effectively,
exactly. It's completely instrumental.
Right. I mean, exactly. Exactly, precisely what you just said, instrumental. It's almost content-free, but it's simply a set of talking points for very hawkish worldview.
Right, and in the end, it ends up discrediting those ideas. As we saw, you know, there was a Freedom House report, you know, the one that came out right when Obama took office, showing that, you know, in the wake of the Bush freedom agenda, freedom was very much on the wane. And one of the reasons, and there was a RAND report as well that made the point that, you know, by making the Iraq invasion and occupion the kind of crowning jewel, the centerpiece of this freedom agenda, the Bush administration had done enormous damage to the democratic brand. But, you know, that's just collateral damage to the bigger goal of starting all kinds of new wars.
I would note
one really interesting thing, though. While I think, you know, Eli was kind of, has been very exercised about the extent to which the cables discredit the Israel lobby thesis. And I've said before to him, although this probably doesn't register in his head, I mean, that I don't subscribe to the entire Israel lobby thesis as described by Walt Mearsheimer, although, of course, I don't subscribe to the idea that they're both raging anti-Semites either. But it's, of course, not mutually exclusive that, you know, there is a faction in the United States that wants us to bomb Iran, and the Arabs do too. I mean, those things can both be true. But I would note that there's a really funny book that came out a few months ago by Mitchell Barr called The Arab Lobby, which made, you know, basically, you know, a very similar argument to the Israel lobby, just, you know, these Arabs, and they've got their partners and their agents here in the United States, and these include, you know, the oil companies and oil lobbyists and this vast network of Arabs who lobby the government and lobby against Israel. And, you know, and it was, of course, praised and hailed by all the same people who called the Israel lobby a work of, you know, the new protocols of the Elders of Zion. But that aside, I mean, these cables do actually disprove that theory. Because, I mean, you haven't seen this domestic Arab lobby agitating for war against Iran. Quite the reverse. You've had these oil interests lobbying, you know, not even against war, but against the sanctions. So, mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure this won't register as well, but it's important to point that out.
Right. No, I mean, you're quite right. I mean, there is, as far as I know, just a very minimal from any sort of domestic Arab groups or domestic Muslim groups in the United States, very little interest in mm-hmm. Waging war and in pushing the United States into war with Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And there's probably some connections between that fact and the fact that the Arab leaders who are calling for these attacks are attempting to keep them secret, right? They're not mm-hmm. announcing publicly yeah. that they're interested in launching such attacks
mm-hmm.
Because they know that such attacks would be quite unpopular with right. their populations.
And I do think it's
of their countries.
Sorry, I mean I think you know let's step back here and look at the picture that these cables do paint of the Middle East in the wake of mm-hmm. the Bush presidency. It's not a pretty one. I mean, it helps to repeat the fact that, you know, Iraq was an enormous boon to Iran. It's become a piece of conventional wisdom because it's completely true. Mm-hmm. You know, Iran's expanded its influence all over the region. So these partners of ours, such as they are understandably nervous. But I think, you know, it'd be a shame if we were to lose this opportunity to really, you know, look at the picture that these cables paint and say, I mean, is this a kind of strategic framework that's sustainable? Is it something we really need to rethink? How long do we keep running on this kind of hamster wheel allied to these, you know, despotic, unrepresentative regimes and kind of coming in and doing their cleanup work for them? I mean, I would make the comparison to Winston Wolfe in Pulp Fiction. But at least Winston put Jules and Vincent to work for him. He didn't actually come in and clean the car. I mean, that's basically yeah. what we're doing. We show up and we clean the exploded head out of the car while Jules and Vincent stand around and do whatever.
That's a fantastic Pulp Fiction reference. I like that. That's good. Maybe I'll try to work in another one later if I can think of a way of doing that.
All right.
I mean, it is quite fascinating. The extent to which so many of these releases do sort of circle around the question of Iran, right? Because, I mean, there's a lot there, but a lot that's really interesting, even as far as, and we'll talk about North Korea a little bit later, but certainly in terms of how U.S. relations with Russia, how U.S. Mm-hmm. relations with China are colored by the question mm-hmm. of Iran. And I think especially, that this is especially true in the case of Russia, that so many of the our considerations in the relationship between the United States and Russia have a ton to do with the relationship between Russia and Iran, which mm-hmm. is part of sort of this containment mm-hmm. system,
yeah.
right? This way of managing the Middle East by, you know, establishing all of these proxies that we have and so mm-hmm. forth. What did you... I don't want to push us too far forward, but what did you gather from the... have you read many of the leaks that focused on Russia and focused on the relationship between Russia and Iran, like the S-300 stuff and so
forth? Yeah, I mean, I read some of that. I skimmed a number of them. I mean, obviously, I paid closest attention to the Middle East. Mm-hmm. As you said, all these are related to the Middle East. There were right. a few very interesting Iraq ones, which might be interesting to come back very briefly to later. But no, I mean, it's, I think, it does describe an enormous amount of diplomatic energy by the Obama administration into the Russia relationship, and I think that's mm-hmm. all to the good. I think they've made right. a very correct strategic analysis of the importance of Russia and the importance in kind of, you know, bolstering that relationship.
Right. I mean, the extent to which Russia is helpful in terms of the sort of the technical expertise that the Russians have, which is unmatched anywhere except in the United States,
mm-hmm.
in things like nuclear weapons and ballistic missile technology, and mm-hmm. sort of turning the capabilities of the Russian intelligence services and so forth in the directions that we're interested in turning them, and how effective that seems to have been in so many cases. I think it was preemptively leaked the Libyan uranium case, which is just really a victory of U.S.-Russian cooperation and non-proliferation,
mm-hmm.
in which the United States and Russia essentially were able to put together a deal over Libyan uranium and were able to prevent the Libyans from backing out of that deal. But then there are so many other cases in which there is sort of real interesting collaboration between the United States and Russia on security interests and things that we tend to think of mainly as U.S. interests. But that also often seem to be affecting Russia in very serious ways as well.
Yeah.
I thought all of that was very interesting. I mean, it paints what I think is a very positive and productive picture of the relationship between the United States and Russia.
Right. No, I think that's true. I mean, there was troubling stuff about the decline of democracy in Russia, which I think is important too. I think this gets back to, I don't know where you are on that, but I think what it, I'm kind of in the camp where I could stand to see a bit more pushing on this stuff from the Obama administration, like across the board, not just in Russia. But again, on the whole, I think it paints a picture of an administration that has been dealing quite responsibly and effectively with this.
Right. Now, sort of when we're sort of vaguely on the topic of how all of these are linked together, I mean, I think you wanted to say at least a word on linkage, right, on the question of because I mean, there have been some arguments about how effectively this doesn't this means that the Arab-Israeli dispute is really sort of irrelevant to Arab regimes and so forth, or that they don't really consider it's important or anything like that. But I mean, I suspect you don't fully agree with that set of claims.
Well, I think there's some confusion as to what the linkage argument is, and I think I've written a number of times that I'm always amazed at the inability or unwillingness of linkage deniers to actually confront and engage with the argument in any honest way. They've got, without resort to these fabulous straw men. No one has ever said that if you, get to a just resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, that all of our problems in the Middle East will go away. That is usually how the argument is misrepresented. There's one argument that says, we need, and I think I've seen this argument out there. I've never made it myself. I know the administration hasn't made it, but just we need to solve Israel Palestine first before we move to Iran. I think the argument is simply that, the Israeli-Palestinian issue is one that drives extremism, it drives resentment, it matters to Arabs and Muslims for understandable reasons, and that it's a well from which extremists can continually draw to power their own rhetoric, and it's a demonstration of Israeli oppression and Western oppression and American oppression and American hypocrisy when it talks about freedom and democracy. So obviously Bin Laden is not making this argument in a genuine way. I can't imagine that Bin Laden, it's kind of irrelevant whether or not Bin Laden himself actually cares about the Palestinians. The fact is the people who he's appealing to care about this issue. Otherwise he wouldn't be saying it. And that's that. It gives him his, what he's saying, some authority. So I think what is shown by I think the argument, as I understand it, was best described I think by General Petraeus earlier this year. He in a statement to the Senate, and then he kind of described it a bit more detail to a reporter shortly after that. But just the general idea that U.S. leadership on this issue in a way that moves toward in a positive direction that shows that the U.S. is engaged on toward resolving this issue in a just way helps us with a lot of other things we want to do in the Middle East. It's actually a fairly modest and I would say staggeringly obvious argument. And yet I think there's a resistance to it by a lot of people, especially in the kind of conservative, the hawkish pro-Israel camp, who really cannot countenance the idea that the U.S.-Israel relationship has any negative impact whatsoever.
Right, right. There are only benefits when there are no costs.
Mm-hmm, right.
It's sort of a unique relationship in history where there are no costs and only benefits. So speaking, and to take
just
the term linkage, what's that? Go ahead.
Just to follow up quickly, and as I said earlier, I think that this is one of, almost as many, if not as many references, to that, issue in the cables as there are to Iran, and almost in many of the cases where these Arab leaders are talking about the U.S. needs to do something about Iran, they're also saying, and by the way, you should also work on the Israeli-Palestinian issue because that will make things easier for us. It will drive, it will help with the problem of extremism, et cetera. So again, to kind of play up the Iran stuff and play down the linkage stuff is just obviously dishonest.
Right, and they're, in fact, they are saying this in private, which apparently means they can be trusted.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. So,
when they talk about Iran, they're telling the truth, but when they talk about Israel, it's al-Takiyya, as we know.
Well, obviously. Now, on sort of on the same general issue of linkage, I mean, I know that you guys at CAP have done a fair amount of work on the new START. So there's a different kind of linkage we're talking about here, which is, you know, we've talked a bit about this sort of very positive and productive relationship that the United States has developed with Russia. Do you have any sort of initial thoughts on how that, I guess another way of phrasing it would be, this seems like a really interesting and productive relationship. It would be a shame to put it at risk presumably killing New START. I mean, I guess opinions differ, but I suspect that if New START is not ratified during the lame duck session, it's not going to be ratified. I mean, that would seem to be an extremely negative consequence for what has been an incredibly useful relationship between the United States and Russia.
Right. No, I agree. And I think it's amazing what an extraordinary consensus there is, both, among the left and many people on the sane right. You've got, you've got the hardline neoconservatives. And I do mean just the hardline neoconservatives, because even Robert Kagan has come out in favor of, even the smart neocon Robert Kagan has come out in favor of START. And it's one of the, it's pretty obvious that here is something, the Republicans have been pretty honest about. They just want to deny President Obama a foreign policy victory. It's pretty darn blatant. And, there's, how does this impact the U.S.-Russia relationship? How does it impact, on a whole range of issues, Iran being one of them, but also how does it impact the U.S. relations with other countries, Iran being at the top of that list, in the event that the U.S. actually wants to sign controversial, treaties with these countries that might be difficult to sell in the United States, but are nevertheless very important for the United States? What kind of signal does it send to these countries that, we'll be able to achieve this with the United States? It doesn't send a good one.
Right. I mean, I know for my own part, last week I was just terribly amused by seeing so many of sort of the institutional right wing. And so here I'm thinking maybe, Eli has a connection with this. Eli was kind of entertaining his Twitter feed as he was trying desperately to get up to speed on arms control, which he knows nothing about. And so he was sending out all sorts of tweets like, can we actually verify Russian nuclear weapons and so forth? All sort of in the purpose of constructing a defense of this indefensible set of claims that is coming out of Heritage and is coming out of the extreme right wing of the Republican Party, that New START is dangerous and so forth. It was fascinating watching him, sort of watching John Noonan, who had this, this sort of commitment to, on the one hand, claiming that New START is great, but on the other hand, saying, "But we don't really need to ratify it because for some reason, because it's not important." And just sort of watching this as people who are sort of sometimes vaguely sane, realizing just how crazy, but sticking to the party line, right? That's what was sort of fascinating and amusing about it on New START.
Well, you almost have to respect that. I mean, they obviously understand they're stuck with a kind of bullshit argument, but hey, they're sticking with
the party. Well, I mean, listen, with you and me, Matt, I mean, I would, I would stick with you over anything, right? I mean, any claim you made, I can't think of a claim that you could make that I would not stick with you on. So, I mean, I don't know. I can't even imagine a claim that I would disagree with you about. So, take that to the bank.
I do. I carry that with me. I'm going to lock it inside my little heart box. Throw away the key.
So, sort of on the same, well, I guess extending another sort of spoke in this argument, one of the interesting cables talked about, and I know Eli and some others have talked, and David Frum have talked about this particular cable, the transfer, this was a cable about a Russian-U.S. meeting, in which the United States asserted that 19 missiles or missile parts, I think at least one full missile and parts of 18 others, had been transferred. These were ballistic missiles of Russian design that had been developed by North Korea or constructed in North Korea, and then had been transferred from North Korea to Iran in 2005. And I think David Frum is claiming this is vindication for his axis of evil.
In 2002.
Cahoots with one another. Well, it's a predictive, right? If it can't predict, then it's not worth anything.
I laughed pretty hard when I saw that. Yes, it's a vindication. Right.
I mean, what was it? Right. I mean, one of the things that was interesting is about this particular. I mean, it's been talked about as if, oh, well, now we know that North Korea transferred these missile parts. Mm. The Russians don't seem to believe that this happened at all. I mean, they seem just to have no. If you read the cable, the Russians just flat out on several occasions say that they do not believe that this transfer occurred. Mm-hmm. And the Americans give, you know, sort of not very compelling reasons for why they believe it did occur. But, I mean, we've never seen either Iran or North Korea test a missile of this kind before. So, I mean, it was kind of interesting, but fascinating in terms of its rhetorical use in justifying the axis of evil speech.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That was fascinating.
I agree.
But since we're in that part of the world... what did you think about the North Korean stuff? I know it's not your specialty, but you're the sort of person who has opinions on stuff. So,
I mean, the reactor stuff before the cables.
The cables about sort of Chinese attitudes towards mm-hmm. North Korea, about South Korea's plans yeah. for a potential reunification after yeah. the North collapses, yeah. So forth. I mean,
well, again, I mean, this is stuff that I did read. You know, pretty briefly, but it's you know, it's again, it's a kind of bizarre, and this is kind of my general response when I try to step back from, you know, my you know a kind of a close view on these you know individual regions, these individual countries, and kind of step back to this kind of strategic framework we've created mm-hmm. slash gotten stuck in. It's just kind of amazing, you know. I mean, I think we tend to have a romantic view of statecraft, and sometimes that's good, and sometimes it's like that. Mm-hmm. But it just strikes me that, you know, I read these cables, and, you know, you really just got to grind this stuff out. You really just got to manage these problems day to day, week right. to week. And the question is, do you manage them responsibly? Do you move the needle in a more positive direction, or do you move it in a negative direction? I mean, I know yeah. that's a bit broad, but, I mean, you know, go ahead. I mean, if you had some specific point on that, I'd love to hear it.
Well, I mean, it's, I mean, the sort of the big revelations kind of came out of, oh yeah, so there was this one cable in particular that's really interesting, and it does sort of go to what you were just talking about how diplomats from all these countries are grinding through these problems, even when they sort of seem intractable, but just because the problem is intractable doesn't, you can't ignore it, right, mm-hmm. it's still there, and you still have to do something about it,
mm-hmm.
And so there was this one particular cable where a South Korean diplomat is, in fact, maybe their vice foreign minister, is talking to a U.S. Official, and is talking about how he, the South Korean, spoke with several Chinese officials, in which the Chinese officials suggested that they would kind of be okay with reunification mm-hmm. of the Korean Peninsula under the Seoul government.
Mm-hmm.
And that just sort of mentions like that just yeah. sort of shine this weird light on the entire diplomatic enterprise.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, what does that exactly mean? On the yeah. one hand, the South Korean could just be, he could have, you know, had a bad translator or something like that, and so mm-hmm. not fully understood. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's also entirely conceivable that some people in China were trying to hint to the South Koreans that, mm-hmm. you know, we're really kind of fed up with North Korea, kind of like yeah. you. And, you know, as long as American forces don't go north of the DMZ, it's not that such yeah. a big deal.
And the South Koreans are like, reunification? What?
right. If you pay for it, that's the South Koreans.
Exactly, yeah.
And so, which of course is, you know, part of the whole problem with the North Korea-South Korea relationship is that even if the South Koreans win, they lose.
Right.
But it's, of course, it's quite fascinating in terms of how you go about interpreting this stuff. Mm-hmm. And normally this interpretation happens sort of behind closed doors, and you can see why it happens behind closed doors. I have a piece I'm writing for tomorrow that is... And I think there are probably a lot of other examples, but this one is sort of very clear, where it would be incredibly irresponsible for the United States not to think about, and for China and for South Korea and for Japan, not to think about the aftermath of a North Korean collapse, because
mm-hmm.
It might happen. I mean, it yeah. might not happen, but it might happen. And if it happens, it's really important. And it would also be amazingly irresponsible for the United States and South Korea and Japan and China not to talk about
mm-hmm.
sort of collaborative activity in terms of a North Korean collapse.
Yeah.
And so you know, both of those, we have to talk about it, and we really should be talking about it with each other. But the third thing is that we can't talk about it publicly, right? I mean, mm-hmm. if the United States and South Korea publicly talk about the collapse of North Korea and policy in the wake of the collapse of North Korea, the North Koreans will never talk to us again.
Yeah.
That they'll just consider it regime change, and any hopes for any negotiations will be dead, right? If the Japanese, you know, if there's a hint that the Japanese have been brought in to discuss anything about this issue, even though it really involves them too,
yeah,
you know, both of the Koreas would just be and China would just be inflamed by anti-Japanese attitudes. And I think a lot of people have made this point, but I think, you know, it bears repetition. There are certain things about diplomacy that require this a cloak of secrecy, and we overcloak. Mm-hmm. But in this particular example, this is a really important issue that almost literally cannot be talked about openly. Right? It has to be talked about behind closed doors.
Right.
I'm very interested in what the fallout from a lot of this stuff is going to be.
Yeah, I agree. I think something related to that, I mean, I totally agree on the secrecy issue. I mean, even on Sunday, right as this stuff was breaking, I mean, there was that was one of the most interesting days on Twitter ever, I think.
Right.
Just, you know, I mean, I had an interesting little exchange with my friend Glenn Greenwald, who, you know, I love Glenn's work, but we just had a bit of a disagreement on this. I think you can kind of separate out these two things. I don't find it controversial mm-hmm. that diplomacy and statecraft require some measure of secrecy and expectation of confidentiality. Mm-hmm. But that's, you know, I see it as somewhat unrelated to the problem that we classify too much and we make too many things secret.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But as you were talking about things that you cannot say but must be discussed and planned for, I think there's a similar issue here with Iran and the nuclear weapon. I mean, it's one thing for the president to draw this red line, as he has continually done, saying that, you know, an Iranian nuclear weapon is unacceptable. But right. it would be irresponsible for the United States not to plan for that contingency, not to talk to its allies about that contingency. And I think, you know, it's pretty clear that we are. It's just how do you deal with that, you know, without telling the Iranians that that you've kind of resigned yourself to that eventuality, thereby, you know, diffusing, you know, any pressure for negotiations.
Right. I'm also kind of fascinated. I mean, I work at a diplomacy school, and my boss is a retired ambassador. And he had a set of very sort of fascinating comments. First, he said that this is going to show the State Department in its best light because there are a ton of good writers in the State Department, and many of them are quite funny. And so, I mean, he seemed to think there are going to be many hilarious cables that are going to come out, maybe we could collect them in a volume, the collected humor of the State Department or something like that.
Although
which,
I did.
You know, would be maybe for next year's Christmas, maybe something like that. Or Hanukkah.
I did note.
Maybe more of a Hanukkah present.
On that point, though, I did note in, it was like a March 2009 cable on a meeting between John Brennan. And this is actually has something I wanted to get to as well, between John Brennan and Saudi King Abdullah. Where one of the headings for one of the sections was, and here's the thing with, you know, without which no Saudi meeting would be complete. And it involves the king's complaint about the slow moving visa process for Saudi citizens mm-hmm. who want to come to the United States for whatever reason. I just thought that was kind of
right.
funny.
Right.
Not roll on the floor funny. But still, funny.
Well, a chuckle-worthy funny. I mean, yeah. maybe, and we should maybe think about editing this volume, since all the information's out there, and you and I could edit it. We could get things on the back, mm-hmm. like, you know, a mildly funny volume of collected State Department mm-hmm. cables, or something along those lines. You know, have a chuckle or two by reading this 400-page book of cable.
Right. Anyway, you know, I foresee, like, my dinner with Rob Farley. With you and I reading these cables to each other over dinner in downtown Lexington.
Right. I mean, I think that's like a two-hour almost blogging hit. We did cameraman and so forth. But, yeah, I think we could do that. And over bourbon, we could sort of slur our speech as the...
Then we take it to Cannes.
Yeah.
That's how we do.
I'm all over it. I'm all over it. Maybe Asanjay will show up in disguise and sort of...
He'll be the waiter.
And the other thing, this came from my conversations with the retired ambassador and others, is the belief on the part of professionals that this kind of release And we should note that professionals, of course, have a particular perspective on this, and they believe that the things that they've made secret should remain secret, and you know, they benefit in a lot of ways from these things being secret. But the argument that's coming from a lot of them is that the long-term downside of a release like this is that people are going to simply stop writing things down, that more things are going to be commuted orally, that are communicated orally, that we will see this information less available. And I mean, as I understand it, this entire download was made possible by an effort by the State Department to make its information more accessible to different parts of the U.S. government. I mean, you can sort of already see the bureaucratic information walls going up around the U.S. government around on issues like this. And so, I mean, and I guess I probably largely suspect that that's right, that that the outcome of this particular set of leaks is not really going to be more open and transparent government, but is going to be government that's more paranoid and that is itself less well-informed because nobody in government is going to talk to anybody else in government.
Well, you know, I think, I would imagine that would be kind of a short-term impact. I mean, I would, you know, maybe I'm being too... you know, entirely too optimistic here, but I mean, hopefully there's some creative thinking going on here in the administration, just because this is the new, this is the era we're now living in. You know, this is going to be happening more. I don't know what you would call it, like the globalization of you know, activism. You know, Assange, as I see it, I mean, I think this is a bit far afield of what we wanted to talk about, but I mean, trying to figure out Assange, there's been a lot of conversation, you know, our debate about what Assange is. Is he a journalist? Is he an activist? I tend to be on the activist side of that. I don't really have much admiration for what he's doing, but I can kind of understand the point of view as I mean, I gather is that, you know, this U.S. policy decisions impact the world. And that, and yet the U.S. government is accountable only to Americans.
So if then
they tell me, so, you know, I can understand that point of view, even if I don't really approve of what he's doing. But again, I think on the, you know, I think the, you know, the Arab governments, as we're already seeing, are going to have some very uncomfortable moments, with their own publics, to the extent that this stuff actually gets reported and it will actually be known in their countries. But I'll be very interested to see how the Arab leaders kind of position as this stuff gets out there and what their response will be, whether they'll just kind of double down on it, given that, I mean, I think we have pretty strong polling data that, you know, Arab publics are pretty overwhelmingly against another war in the Middle East for understandable reasons, because wars kill huge numbers of people. But I think, you know, I should say, you know, I'm a supporter of the Obama administration, so, but still, I do think that they come out looking fairly well, fairly, you know, they're diplomats. I think there's been some surprise from people on the right who always have had a kind of dim view of the State Department, you know, the idea of the State Department are Arabists, or they're this, or they're that, or they're, you know, cultural captives of the various countries they in. I mean, what we see in these documents is that these are very effective public servants. They're giving very candid reports, helpful, and you know they're standing strong on certain positions where they should in a lot of cases.
Right. No. I mean, well, I mean, it showed really. And this is another thing I wanted to bring up about Eli, where he made this bizarre comment about suddenly learning that State Department people are tough and smart, which is just fascinating for any, I mean, these, again, I know a ton of State Department people, and it's not just, I mean, the Obama administration is a big part of this, but, I mean, there's also sort of something to recommend the very competent and professionalized diplomatic corps of the United States that manages to sort of carry out and handle all these problems at the behest of the administrations.
In fairness to Eli, I think his point, I think Eli generally understands that. I think he was kind of characterizing more the broader conservative view there.
Right. The contempt of diplomats. Yeah,
right.
Contempt for
diplomats.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is, you know, it's a nonsense point of view, but I think he was just describing it, and he was right that this kind of shows that point of view really, really isn't correct.
Right. And of course, I mean, in all of this, there are certain silly bits and so forth. I mean, I guess in the overall embarrassment category, the embarrassment isn't necessarily. The embarrassment is only to the United States insofar as the United States, you know, failed to keep this stuff secret. But, I mean, a lot of other governments are sort of, it seems, almost going to be more deeply embarrassed by the Americans' view of them than the U.S. is going to be embarrassed by anything that comes out in this.
Or, you know,
I do wonder, what's that? Go ahead.
Well, no, or in the case of Erdogan, who I think is probably gonna take this stuff to the bank. You know,
right.
He's got, you know, he's just... I'm just seeing, you know, friends, you know, Turkish friends are kind of, there's some signs of this, but, you know, we'll see over the next couple of weeks. But, you know, he's got evidence that, you know, he's got America concern, and we'll see. He's very good at kind of weaving this stuff into his kind of populist political story. So we'll see how he does.
Mm-hmm. Right. I thought that was actually very interesting, the Turkey stuff. The Turkey stuff I found mildly surprising.
Mm-hmm.
The degree of contempt, or not really contempt, I mean, there was some contempt, but the degree of skepticism about the current Turkish regime on the part within the diplomatic corps was very interesting.
Yeah, I find, you know, I mean, we've got to move on, but just briefly, I mean, I'm constantly fascinated by both Turkey and by the American kind of elite reaction to Turkey,
right.
Given that, you know, we... Americans are almost unique in, no, not almost, we are pretty unique among the most modern countries in the extent to which religion plays a part in our politics.
Right.
And
right.
Here we have a country that is very much like that, and we don't seem to be able to match that up.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, okay, to the last issue we were going to talk about today. So there was this recent poll in the United Kingdom that said that something like 80% of the people wanted the succession to skip Charles and go straight to William. What are your thoughts on that? I know you have strong opinions.
I don't know. You know, I would speak up for Charles, but my Prince Charles junket fell through last week, so he's gone. You know, I am not a Prince Charles supporter. You know, Sorry.
I never back off of my defenses for you, so I guess I'll have to say that I strongly support the position that you just enumerated. So,
well
done. As coherent as it may be.
Well done. But I should say that if that junket comes through, you know, if Prince Charles wants to fly me out there, visit his, you know, he has like an organic farm in Scotland or something, right?
I believe so, yes.
Chuck.
Then you'll expect me, and I will, make an immediate 180 on
I'll let
this
you
particular
know.
Issue.
I'll let you know. We'll work for junkets.
Well, is there anything else we want to talk about before we leave the fine people?
I don't know. Maybe just how we should cut that whole last bit about Prince Charles out?
Yeah, probably. We'll leave it to the editors.
Leave
it to the editors. They know the wisdom. All right, well, I mean, is there anything else we should talk about?
I'm sure there are many, many other things, but I think that's good for now.
All right. Well, then, I hope to see you soon, and thank you to the viewers for sticking it out this long.
See you later.
All right, bye-bye.